This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please.
Case number 07-1262 et al. Dean Transportation, Inc. Petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Corey for the petitioner. Ms. Beard for the respondent. Mr. Ario for the intervener.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Corey. I represent the petitioner, Dean Transportation, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. This court should not enforce the board's decision, which creates a situation in which two groups of special education drivers, driving students to the same schools, working for the same highly centralized employer, working for the same customer under the same customer contract, in a state special education system mandated to be regionalized to be more efficient across district lines, somehow wind up belonging to two different unions with two sets of negotiators and demands, two different bargaining relationships, two different sets of wages and benefits, with one of the two unions weakened because it no longer represents all such drivers company-wide, and the other now representing an island in a sea of drivers represented by its rival, never having any real experience under the applicable federal labor law rules negotiating with his highly centralized employer, and also at the same time having the responsibility to represent a half dozen better compensated mechanics who answer to their own chain of command, plus a couple of salaried route planners who make up to $50,000 a year, and query who will speak for them at the table in this unstable bargaining environment the board's decision has created. This fragmented situation that is the result of the board's decision will result in rivalry, in friction, and disruption in the context of the provision of an important public service. Yet peace and stability in labor relations are the central purposes of labor law and must inform the board's work. This is not a rational result consistent with the law's purpose. How did the board get so far off track in this case? Let me highlight some of the primary reasons. First, the single facility presumption should not have been used at all in this case. This case, given the facts that I've just described, we don't believe is like any other that we've seen before. The single facility presumption should not have been used at all, and one reason is the history of the units that are at issue in this case. And the board has a selective and a revisionist notion of this history, which inevitably leads to the irrational, unprecedented result that I've described. The board likes to cite the proposition that a single facility presumption is particularly strong whereas here, referring to the facts in those cases, employees had historically been represented in a single facility unit.
May I interrupt you and ask you?
Yes, ma'am.
If you would, because I'm looking at this in a different way, why is Dean not a successor employer?
Why is Dean not a successor employer? The test for successor involves a couple of steps. It involves first a question of whether or not there is substantial continuity in the workforce, and also a look at whether a majority of the employees that Dean hires came from the prior workforce. Both of those steps are a means to an end. They're not the real end. The real end there is whether to determine whether that presumption of majority support that the union enjoyed previously with the prior employer continues and can be extended to Dean. That's the first step. The second step.
Well, the first thing you said was continuity. How is this not, how are these bus drivers not doing exactly what they did when they were represented by GRESPA?
In many ways, Your Honor. And we believe the board has taken really too cosmetic or perfunctory of a look at what it means to do the same thing. With respect to the bus drivers, the board, in our mind, analyzes that as, well, do they still drive a bus? Do they still put a key in and turn a steering wheel? That's true. But from the beginning of their employment with Dean, they underwent different training, which this court has said in City Steel, I believe, among other cases, is an important and significant difference in continuity. They underwent a number of different procedures that they have to go through. One of the drivers said she does twice the work now that she did when she previously worked for the Grand Rapids Public Schools. They are subject to a large number of different policies, different from the ones that they previously drove under.
What kind of policies? You mean just dean's policies or dealing with what?
Different kinds of policies, Your Honor. Personnel policies, again, dean established its own set of terms and conditions of employment policies for these individuals. Plus, there were a lot of operational kinds of policies, forms that had to be filled out, mileage forms, and for a driver, again, to have this additional paperwork changes their work. The other big change for the drivers was in the way that routes were assigned. And again, keep in mind these are drivers. Previously, the drivers picked the routes they worked. Or I'm sorry, previously the drivers were assigned the routes that they worked. Now, under Dean, they pick them based on their seniority. That's a big difference for a driver. And that does change the job. So, in fact, while drivers still drive, they don't do the job in the same manner unless you look at it on that surface level of, well, they still
drive. Looking at that on the surface level, the court, the agency, the ALJ has the following statement at 1477. It says, the undisputed evidence establishes that after taking over the transportation services, the respondent employer continued transporting essentially the same regular and special education students to the same schools, utilizing essentially the same buses, with the majority of the same drivers. At least during the first year of the contract, the drivers were following the same routes as before, with variations based on changes in census data. The routes were planned by the same route planners, a majority of whom held the same positions, using the same computer software as before, working in the same office as before. The buses were still parked in the same lot at 900 Union. Drivers continued to punch the same time clock, continued to gas up the buses at the same pump. The buses continued to be maintained and repaired in the same garage. The drivers continued to use the same building for their driver's lounge. Is all that true or false?
Your Honor, a couple different points in response to that. First of all, if you notice that the ALJ says at least for the first year.
Yeah.
As a matter of contract, when Dean took over that operation, it agreed for a year to leave the routes as the same as possible to alleviate disruption on the parents and students.
Does that possibly mean that during the first year it's a successor and after that suddenly it stops?
Well,
I think you don't usually change that after a year's progress. You have to have a new election.
You have to look at, again, that statement in context in terms of saying that the routes were the same. The routes were intended to be altered, to be regionalized on this special ed basis. That's why the whole consortium existed with the Kent Intermediate School District, including the Grand Rapids Public Schools, on that. So the 1 year was a transitional period. That wasn't designed to be permanent. And even within that 1 year, routes were changed, as ALJ recognized. What the ALJ doesn't include in that laundry list, again, are the number of things that we believe, and under this court standard, it's whether those employees view their jobs as being unaltered, is all the things that would have made a difference, the different training, the different trainers, all the living with a centralized private employer.
Considerably different changes than occurred in this case, and we still have held that that doesn't change the way in which the employees view what their job is. Just so much different that it's not even comparable to this case.
Right. But I think, Your Honor, again, in this case, we have to look at the totality of circumstances, which is the standard for whether there is substantial continuity. And those things include, for example, in the case of the mechanics who are in this unit, the fact that they have absolutely brand new supervisors and brand new systems and are working with other people in other close by facilities that are also Dean facilities. You have the fact, again, from a substantial continuity standpoint, that there are big differences in the size of the unit. And these employees who at one time worked for a public school system, and this is the nature of the employer, which is part of the standard, now work for a private company. And it's very different to work for a public school system with 568 people in a unit that has 39 classifications, and then go to work for Dean, which is a private employer based in our way, centralized management there, but also new regional managers who the employee testified and the regional manager testified show up at least once a week at Dean's facility. So there's a new hierarchy there, and there are new rules governing this situation.
How many classifications does Dean have?
DTU contract? I believe it's drivers and attendants. It's no more than two or three. It's a driver's contract. In fact, the unit description of Dean is all drivers. And we believe that's significant here in terms, again, the history of the units. But again, going back to the issue of the board's notion of what that history is here, again, the board likes to use that single facility presumption to talk about how that is particularly strong where there is a history of single facility bargaining. But the history here is exactly the opposite. And the converse of that should be true, that if it's not a historical single facility unit, then it should be weaker. In fact, if it was a multi-facility unit, which it was, it had 39 classifications throughout 200 buildings, some 10 miles away, some not even within the school district grounds, then the multi-facility presumption should be strong. And this is not an academic point. Again, the board tends to rely on presumptions here instead of looking at what makes sense. And the premise of looking at history or elevating history as a criterion is that it's supposed to promote stability and minimize disruption. And that's based on the premise that the status quo is preserved. But if the board looks back to a time that never existed here, that invites disruption as a result. And so history belies, it doesn't bolster that single facility presumption. History should have prevented this result from happening as well, because even if the board applies that single facility presumption, that presumption can be rebutted, and the case law is that we don't have to show overwhelming evidence to rebut that. And one of the factors used to rebut it, again, is history. And here the board looked back to a time when there was a public sector history with a union that bargained under different rules and with employees that lived under a different set of rules, including not having the right to strike.
I didn't see the right to strike issue raised before the agency.
The differences in the statutes were raised. We raised
all
the differences in the statutes.
You do use those words, and the board, of course, has a number of cases in which it says, notwithstanding that it's a public, went from public to private,
right,
doesn't matter. But how were they to know that you wanted a specific discussion or that you were raising with them specifically this issue of strikes? That is, the board has, at least in two cases which were cited, said that it doesn't matter whether it's public or private. You're raising, I take it, a new or additional argument.
What we had raised in terms of the totality of circumstances in our brief to the board,
yes,
was the different regulatory schemes that impact the public and the private,
right,
sector. We didn't do a side-by-side comparison of all the different
the strike
things.
Issue at all.
We didn't mention the strike issue. The strike issue was brought up by the amicus parties.
The amicus was denied, so that wasn't before the board. And that would leave us with the question of whether they had arbitrarily and capriciously or something like that.
Which their chairman thought they had.
Maybe, but you don't make that argument.
That's correct. But that specifically raised the strike piece of this different public to private scheme, but we think it's included within that. There's another factor here that should have been enough to overcome the rebuttable presumption, and that's the factor of employee interchange. There's a case called DADCO, which the ALJ ignored, and the board works hard to try to distinguish here. They have to distinguish it because, in fact, it's our case. In fact, our case is even better than DADCO for rebutting the presumption in some ways. And there are two factors in DADCO that the board, there was a very significant factor the board didn't cover in DADCO, and that is they didn't recognize this interchange that I talked about at the beginning where every day dozens of bus drivers from Union Street and 36th Street go to the same schools working for the same customer, doing the same jobs in exactly the same manner under the same policies. And the board's decision here will
The board described DATCO, and it seems to me correctly, as a case where fully one-third of the bus drivers were shuttled from their home facilities to other terminals on a daily basis. Did that occur here?
No, Your Honor, not like that. But we had interchange, which I believe is even more significant from a work standpoint, and that is most of the drivers at Union Street and all the drivers at 36th Street drive special ed buses. And those drivers all go to the same schools every day to do their job. And so from a work standpoint,
they come out of their Home Depot and go back to that depot.
Right. In DADCO, the employees all went to a terminal to pick up a bus to go do their job. In our case, the employees take their bus from their terminal to their job site, the school, and wait there to pick up students. I'd like to reserve the remainder of time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Beard.
Good morning. I'm Heather Beard, representing the National Labor Relations Board, which is seeking enforcement of its order. The board's order is supported by substantial evidence, and thus it should be upheld. Indeed, the board's order upholds the rights of over 100 former Grand Rapids Public School System employees who freely chose GRESPA as their bargaining representative, but whose choice was thwarted when Dean became a bona fide successor to the Grand Rapids Public Schools bargaining obligation, but forced the GRESPA represented employees to join another union, DTEU. And the facts in this case are straightforward. The Transportation Department employees at 900 Union Street in Grand Rapids, Michigan, are a unit that include not only bus drivers, but also mechanics and route planners. Prior to June of 2005, this group of employees was part of a larger unit represented by GRESPA, non-clerical, non-teaching employees. In early April of 2005, Grand Rapids Public Schools contracted out the Transportation Department at 900 Union Street to Dean. And Dean now runs this terminal in substantially the same way that the Grand Rapids Public School systems had the jobs of these employees, with the majority of former Grand Rapids Public School employees from that terminal. However, instead of recognizing GRESPA and bargaining, Dean told the employees they had to join DTEU as a condition of employment. They applied DTEU and Dean's contract to these employees and deducted their dues. And in doing so, as we show, Dean and DTEU violated the act in numerous ways. And this is premised the first...
How long was GRESPA the bargaining or the union for the employees?
GRESPA had been certified as the union for the employees, I believe, since the 1970s is what the record shows. They had been doing so. The most recent contract was going to expire in June of 2006 between GRESPA and the Grand Rapids Public Schools for this particular location.
What was the group of employees who broke off from GRESPA? Were they the mechanics or were they the route or dispatchers?
There were three.
The one that has that long... initials,
right?
GROE, whatever it is.
GRESPA, right. GRESPA contained bus.
Not GRESPA, the other one. There were some of the employees.
GRAOP?
Yes.
The dispatchers were represented by GRAOP.
But that was recent, right?
Right. That was within the last couple of years relevant to this case. That's correct.
Did it happen before June of 2005?
GRAOP had broken off, I believe, before June of 05. Yes, that's correct. So the failure to bargain finding against Dean is premised on two findings that you were discussing earlier, Dean being a successor to Grand Rapids Public Schools and the former unit remaining an appropriate one. And I think the evidence in this record is clear that there was substantial continuity between the two operations in this case law of this circuit, as well as board case law, is indicative of this particular case falling comfortably within the sphere where we have changes are made, obviously, by the new employer. However, they're not significant enough to change from the employee's perspective their jobs on a daily basis. And here, the evidence, as Your Honor was reading, was overwhelming and not contested that much of what the employees do from their perspective was the same as it was when they worked under the Grand Rapids Public School System. Although they were a discrete part of the former unit, this court's precedent in community hospitals, which we cited in our brief, is clear that simply because there is a subset of a group that is centrally located and together as a subset of a larger unit does not mean the single facility presumption does not apply. And so when you...
Would it mean if Dean Transportation were correct and the system-wide unit that they have or bargaining that they had, suppose they didn't have it, they weren't unionized at all. But if their arguments were correct, would it mean that in this case that these 100 and some Union Street employees would not be represented by a union?
Well, I would say two things. First, these employees would always be represented by GRESPA until and unless the employees filed some sort of decertification or other type of petition. If there was no Dean Transportation Employees Union, the employer would still have an obligation as a successor to recognize the selected bargaining representative, which would be GRESPA. However, the independent finding that the board made in this case is that even if this court was to find that the Dean Transportation was not a successor, that independently, these employees did not accrete to the unit that was at the Dean Transportation to the DTEU. So these employees would be represented by GRESPA from the successorship finding, and therefore that is where the rights flow for the employees to have GRESPA. If the employees were accreted two, which is the contention that is the burden there is shouldered very heavily by Dean to accrete these employees to the existing unit. If that had occurred, then there could be no finding that the GRESPA unit had continued to be the bargaining representative. However, the findings in the record and the facts in the record are overwhelming that GRESPA was succeeded by Dean Transportation. And so that's why, because the substantial continuity between these two operations continued, GRESPA, the employees, who are the ones whose rights here we are concerned with, are being thwarted by having to not go with their initial choice of GRESPA. Now, the only other way now, that
wait
the...
Wait a minute. I mean, that's... their wishes... Has somebody taken a poll of these people?
Well, during the transition from the time that GRPS transitioned over to Dean and Dean took these employees, if Dean is a bona fide successor, the law states under board law that you do not poll or do anything of the sort to the employees. What you do is if they have a recognized bargaining representative, the employer recognizes them. However, the employer does have, under Supreme and board case law, the employer and employees do have a right if they either believe that there's objective evidence that there's no support anymore, or that the employees don't.
I mean, the last time these employees, that's why I asked you this question, the last time they expressed any view about wanting this union or not, you said was in the 1970s, right?
Well, I'm not sure.
And even if there had been an election, if it were a close election and a majority of union or majority of people supported the union, when you're talking about less, even if it had been contemporary, when you're talking about lopping off a hunk of the former unit, you can't be sure that the people in that little piece are the ones that voted for the union or against it. So this is all built on presumptions. And when you said, you know, the employee's choice, I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. You can't poll. It's a unfair labor practice to do this. Huh?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, because it is the employee's choice that we're trying to preserve, and the only choice the employees here had made was with the union GRESPA, who had a functioning collective bargaining agreement with these employees, that is why the law presumes if there is substantial continuity in business, the disruption should not occur in the collective bargaining representative. So to that respect, that is why the choice of these employees is relevant. And in terms of the presumptions here, the board not only relied on presumptions, the board also looked at all the other factors combined. So they were not only looking at the fact that these employees had all been together for years, they had all bargained together for years, but that this facility at 900 Union Street shared an important community of interest. And at this facility, these individual employees interacted with each other much more so than they would be interacting with any other of the employees at any of the other facilities at Dean. They were supervised by separate supervisors, and they were the only contract that Dean had here at 900 Union Street, where there were regular education drivers driving along with the special education drivers. So when you take the presumptions that the board appropriately applied, as this court has approved, even in a subset case in community hospitals, we have the presumptions and we have all of the other community of interest factors and successorship cases that militate towards finding here that this, that militate towards the company not showing this was an inappropriate unit. And that's really what we're talking about here. When we have successorship, when we have this type of evidence, the burden rests with the employer to demonstrate that there should be some sort of breaking up of the original collective bargaining obligation. So when this occurred, when this happened, and the employees were told you either join DTEU or you don't have a job, their stable collective bargaining relationship had been interrupted. And I would also like to say that the contentions that were raised by my opposing party with regard to DATCO, the board did thoughtfully deal with DATCO, and the record in this case is very different from DATCO with regard to the way that the employees come to the job and fulfill their jobs. As Your Honor pointed out, a third of the employees in DATCO were going from their home terminal to other terminals. In this case, the folks who go to 900 Union Street, they drive to the schools, and then they they come back. And the ALJ specifically noted that any social interaction that would have occurred at any school that may be dropped off by the employees at the 900 Union Street facility and others, that any of that interaction was minimal, particularly compared with the fact that the Grand Rapids Public Schools all have their employees driving students to schools and to educational programs for special education students that Grand Rapids are within the confines of Grand Rapids, other than one school, the Lincoln School. So when you look at the evidence here overall, as the board did, considering the precedent that the board did, think that it is clear that substantial evidence supports the board's decision in this matter. And insofar as any other presumption I would just like to raise that is being brought up here, my opponent raised the system-wide presumption. This was not properly raised in front of the board that there should be a different affirmative presumption. The system-wide presumption, as in the Alyeska cases, applies in a completely different set of circumstances to public utilities and their sole source providers, which is not analogous herein and which was not appropriately before the board. And as I see my time is wrapping up, I'd just like to conclude by asking this court to enforce the board's well-reasoned decision because it's supported by substantial evidence. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ariel.
Thank you. Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Phil Iorio. I'm appearing on behalf of the intervener in this case, GRESPA. I join counsel for the board in requesting the court enforce in total the board's order. I'd like to address several points. First, the respondent company is advocating a position that contravenes established successor case law, as has been enunciated by the Supreme Court in Fall River and Burns and has been applied in numerous cases by the board since. The company in this case is seeking the power to anoint the representative of the employees at Union Street and to impose a contract on those employees. The company argues that it should have the power to pick the employees' representatives. And in this case, they're arguing in picking the DTEU, a sweetheart union that first had contact with employees at Union Street when the president of the DTEU was introduced by the company owner, Kelly Dean, at a back-to-school meeting. This occurred after Dean, the company, had told the employees that as a condition of employment, they had to sign dues checkoff cards. This was told, the employees were told that they would have to be in the union. The employees were told that the DTEU contract would cover them. The employer's theory conflicts with applicable successorship law and the basic notion that employees possess the right to select a representative of their own choosing. In this case, the employees exercised free choice, and they did it in 1993, just so the record is clear. In 1993, the state, in a certified election, certified GRESPA after a vote as the bargaining representative, and the vote was overwhelming, and that's in the appendix.
Let me ask you about the transition bonus. Maybe I'm confused. I thought if the driver didn't join DTEU, he didn't get the transition bonus.
Well, the record evidence is, and there was a driver who testified, that when she went to fill out the application, she was given a DTEU dues checkoff authorization card. She asked what it was. They said, "This, you have to sign this. You're going to be in the union." That was the record. Also the record was at one of the meetings where they're explaining to the Grand Rapids employees about the DTEU union. The owner advised that there was a DTEU union and that all the employees would be in the union.
And what about the transition bonus? What were they told?
The transition bonus applied to encourage Grand Rapids employees to work at the Union Street facility after the transfer to Dean. Employees would be paid $250 a week for the first year, $150 a week for the second year. That's shows that also a wage disparity between the facility at Union Street and the facility at the 36th Street, because the drivers at Union Street were paid a much higher rate than these drivers at 36th Street. Not only did the employees exercise free choice, I see that my time is up.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
Thank you. In 1993, by voting, but they affirmed that choice seven times after that by negotiating and bargaining and voting on contracts. At any time during that time, they could have, if they had not wanted GRESPA to represent them, disaffiliate or decertify, which they did not do.
One fourth of the the employees at the Union Street were not members of the GRESPA union, is that right?
The record is that in September 1, when the operation had fully ramped up, there were approximately 145 drivers, route planners, and mechanics, the unit. Of those, 107 were formerly in.
So about 25% of them were not former.
I think that's right. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Corey have any time left?
Thank you. As Judge Randolph points out, there is this double dilution here where you get from the 568 down to 100 with another 45 or so employees who never worked for GRESPA or never worked with GRESPA. Not everyone at Union Street received the transition bonus, only those employees from Grand Rapids Public Schools. So those 25% of the drivers did not receive the transition bonus and were paid exactly the same thing as the Union Street, as the 36th Street drivers. Judge Henderson mentions the dispatchers. That's another issue in this case, and this is anything but a straightforward case, because when the union makes its request for recognition, which must be a conditioned precedent to a bargaining charge, the union specifically asks for the dispatchers.
That's not an argument that's been discussed yet, and this is a separate one of your arguments that you raised in your opening.
That's correct. You mentioned the dispatchers when they came in.
Rebuttal. The problem I'm having here is that, in a way, you're re-arguing the case to us, and the real issue is what our standard of review is. I'm just going to read to you from Herder Tomato. Pointing to differences in size, wages, benefits, training, customer base, managerial philosophy, and supplier contracts, among others, HTPC argues that the two companies are substantially dissimilar and that HTPC's employees would perceive a material difference. Though plausible, this argument is unresponsive to the question that we face. We ask not whether the employer's view of the facts support its version of what happened, but rather whether the board's interpretation of the facts is reasonably defensible. That's really the issue here, not even whether the preponderance of the evidence supported you below, but whether on our review it's reasonably defensible. So all these differences have to amount to more differences than there were in any of our other cases before we can say it wasn't reasonably defensible.
Your Honor, I think that's with respect, and I think you're quoting Harder there on one prong of this.
On the successorship,
yes. not the unit issue, and not whether presumptions are properly applied in that unit issue, for example.
So are you giving up on the successorship issue?
No, sir, I'm not.
So then I'm correct on the successorship issue.
On the successorship issue, I believe you stated the standard correctly. But there is also standard and that was enunciated by Judge Henderson in City Steel that in a successorship, the court must examine carefully both the findings and the reasoning of the board. Yeah. And it distinguished it somewhat from Harder in that case. And the reasonings of the board also must comport with the purpose of the law and must be rational. And with respect to the board's decisions, this court has also said in the IUE case that it will uphold the board's decisions if they are rational and in accord with precedent and consistent with the act.
It's the same thing. Rational and reasonable, those words mean the same thing to us with this respect. So we have
correct,
to say the board's decision is not rational.
And Your
you
Honor,
want to get to where you want us to get to.
That's correct. But if you look at the result that results here from this decision, and you look at the fact that we believe it's unprecedented to have two employees from two different unions doing the same job for the same centralized employer, for the same customer, at the same location. And again, we talk about the interchange there. Counsel for the board said that's
case,
social.
Is there any case that decides a successorship issue based on a theory about industrial strife, that's what's going to resolve this question?
I think, Your Honor, if you go back to Burns and the granddaddy of them all in successor cases and follow that track, it's all about industrial strife. And again, Judge Henderson said
but that decides a case where on the facts it meets the successorship requirements, but because there are two unions involved rather than one, successorship can't be found.
Your Honor, I think
it would seem to me that in many cases anyway, there would be two unions involved in successorship cases.
You don't see them. And I think that and again, and this is responding to something counsel for the union said, which is not in the record here, and we take
I'm gonna say you're not a sweetheart union.
It's a sweetheart union. That is not true here. But I think in most instances, Your Honor, from my experience now, when you have two unions in a situation, there is some respect.
Represent employees at any other companies?
No, sir. It's independent union. It goes back 30 years. It's state certified.
Only
Dean. All drivers at Dean and at seven other locations. And we believe in most situations, the reason why you don't see these cases is that unions have, you know, various agreements or whatever that they have where you don't see them clashing. Here, they're clashing, and Dean is stuck on the horns of that dilemma between these two unions who have a claim to this facility, both have a claim to the facility. And again, in the City Steel case, the emphasis has to be on focusing on promoting industrial peace and the unrest that may occur. And what we're saying is this situation results in unrest, not the opposite, which is the purpose of the law.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.